Thank you. I'm gonna set myself up here. Okay. Right. I need this kind of here. Okay. So, before I get started, I want to congratulate everyone who competed tonight. I know just how much gumption it takes to get up here. I'm feeling the fear right now. But it's okay, because I got my lucky t-shirt. It's a great word, gumption. The world needs more gumption. I also want to thank Paul Casey and Uvail for giving me and all of those who participated in the slam the opportunity to scare ourselves shitless. And I want to thank all of you who came here tonight to be the audience. Because what is a performance poet without an audience? Just some kind of mad loony person barking at the walls, you know? So, I got the mic. I got the audience. What am I gonna do with all this power? With all this fear? I remember a night at Ovale when a friend of mine, and I won't mention his name, he's out there in the back, got up and did a terrific performance of a poem he learned and rehearsed. And when I went up and congratulated him, he said, "Was it okay? Because I didn't want to seem pretentious." And I said, "Dude, you're standing up in front of a room full of people. You've got a mic. You're asking them to shut up and listen to you. It's pretentious. Get over it." So, the stage is about gumption. And the stage is about being a little pretentious. There's a lot of petty bickering in the poetry world about page and stage. I don't get it myself. A page poet once said to me, when discussing performance poetry, "You know, it's not enough to be brave." And I thought, well, maybe, but sure as hell helps. So, page or stage, page or stage. I never really got what the big deal was about. I'm one of those people that are described as being bridging page and stage, or balancing between page and stage, as if we were teetering on two extreme, exclusively unstable continents. Is there a fundamental difference between page and stage? Hell yeah. Is one better than the other? Hell no. Can you do both? Damn right you can. But my page poet friend was right. If you're gonna get up on the stage, you gotta be brave. So, I got the mic. I got the audience. Will I be brave? Well, you can't be brave if you don't feel the fear. So I decided to make sure that I'd be good and scared tonight. Because who am I to tell you that you should be brave if I come out here tonight and just do the same poems that I've done a dozen times and that don't scare me at all? So I decided to do something different. I decided to do something I'd never done before. To put together something that was raw and that was new. And it comes with a trigger warning. For those of you who don't know the definition of a trigger warning, it's used to alert people when an internet post or an article or a book or a performance or some other media could potentially cause extremely negative emotional reactions to to the content. I didn't know that first time I saw trigger warning. I thought it meant something completely different. This is trigger warning. I have never been raped. I have never been beaten, smacked, slapped, or thrown onto the floor. I have never been stripped. I've never been punched, choked, kicked, or shoved into a door. And so, the first time I saw trigger warning, I thought it was an alert, a call to arms, a warning that this news item I was gonna read was gonna make me so angry that I'd want to lock and load, aim at the bastards, and pull the trigger. Now that you've been warned, I thought that you should all need a little lesson in feminist theory. I'm a woman, I'm a feminist, and it informs what I write. And for those of you who don't understand what that means, I wrote a handy little poem called A Short Lesson in Feminist Theory. So, it's because the personal is political, darling. It's because the personal is political, baby. It's because the personal is political, lady. It's because the personal is political, mister. It's because the personal is political, sister. It's because the personal is political, minister. It's because the personal is political, stupid. It's because the personal is political, fuckwit. It's because the personal is political, you piece of shit. It's because the personal is political, you bourgeois git. It's because the personal is political. Do you get it? It's because the personal is political. Say it. The personal is political. The personal is political. Come on. The personal is political. More. The personal is political. The personal is political. Very good. The personal is political. And so you see, if you fuck with me, I'm going to take it personally. Through my personal and therefore political things that have been on my mind. Been on my mind for about a year. As Paul said, I write poetry, I write nonfiction, I write fiction, and it's all the same to me. So I thought I'd kind of mix it up tonight, and I'll do some poems. And I'll read you some stuff as well. And this is a piece I wrote probably last April for the Bogman's Canon. I encourage you all to go and have a look on the website of the Bogman's Canon. And it's called It's the End of the World as They Know It. We like playing the apocalypse game at home. We've played it for years now. It's both reassuring and titillating to imagine what we would do when the shit hits the fan. The basic premise is a zombie apocalypse. Could we survive in the 3 acres that I own? I figure we'd be fine. We have water, we grow food, we can fish and hunt. We could build barriers at both ends of the road and pick out the zombies one by one with bows and arrows. For real, like, I do archery. Playing the apocalypse game mainly consists of sitting around the table planning. That's about it, really. It's kind of like Cards Against Humanity, but without the cards and with more purpose. Whether you make the team or whether you're zombie bait is part of the fun. You can't be on the A-team if you have no practical skills. Some of the ones on our team have gun and explosive knowledge. I have to admit, they're mainly Americans. Some have building or weaving or brewing knowledge. A dear friend, whose name won't be mentioned, but who is a well-known poet and an activist, was very disappointed to find out that his only value to the Apocalypse team, apart from being zombie bait, was brute force. He's a big, strong lad, and brute force is valued more highly than writing poetry is on the A-team. Being able to shift a pile of rocks is handier than being able to write a poem. I mean, hell, everybody on the A-team can write poetry. It's strangely comforting to strip your identity down to whether you'd be useful to the group when the end of the world as we know it rolls into town. Can you feed? Can you defend? Everything you are distilled into how good you are at staying alive. But a zombie apocalypse is a lot less scary than contemplating what might really happen. Because the shit is going down on this planet. We know them water levels gonna rise. This planet's gonna fry. Those reservoirs are going to run dry. In fact, they already are. Those poor people are gonna get fed up and go after them rich people. It could be soon. Could be in 50 years' time. It could happen little by little or in the mother of all clusterfucks. I think that most of us hope that the apocalypse will come not with a bang, but with a whimper, trickling its poison so slowly that we'll hardly notice until it's too late. I've taken to asking young people, where are you gonna be in 2050? It's a question that every person who's still gonna be around needs to ask themselves. Because, ladies and gentlemen, we may be playing the apocalypse game in my little patch of paradise in West Cork. But for loads of people all over the world, it's already the end of the world as they know it. In this little green theme park of a nation, we are largely shielded from the hordes of people all over this planet who have had to up and leave. Imagine, for just a minute, join up the dots of all these groups of people, some just a dozen, some 100, some 1,000, some in a group of 100,000 in a refugee camp in Syria. They are roaming the planet because the shit hit the fan and destroyed the world as they knew it. They are wandering over mountains. They are walking along roads. They are sleeping in tents, in bus shelters, in railway stations. They are sitting in their thousands at the foot of a wall covered in barbed wire. They are crouching under a road near Calais, waiting for a truck to slow down. They are drifting on a boat in the middle of the Mediterranean, trying to get a signal on their phone right now.
This is tough. Let me get this in the right sense, and then I'll be fine. So, I've been thinking a lot, as you can imagine, I'm sure you all have as well, about the refugees and about their plight. And when I think about all the refugees out there tonight, it makes me feel angry. It makes me feel sad. But most of all, it makes me feel helpless. And I wrote this poem about it. Helpless. I am wasting water, Soraya. I let the dog's bowl overflow. Watch the hose whip like an angry snake, gushing water into the yard, splashing my feet, scaring the dogs, spraying a river of rainbows. I am wasting water, Soraya. I am wasting it for you. I am wasting water, Malinka. I press the shower at the pool again and again. Let hot water cascade over my head, like a halo, a waterfall, a virgin's mantle. Till my skin is rosy red, my body wet and warm, smelling of coconut. I am wasting water, Malinka. I am wasting it for you. I am wasting water, Amal. I fill the bath to the brim, pour perfumed oils, blue bubbles, scented salt, light candles and soak, pull the plug when it gets a little colder. Add more hot water for you, Malinka. I am wasting it for you. I am wasting water, Rina, like the water wasted you, flung you up out of the boat, wrapped you in its waves, tore your children from your arms, entered your nose, your mouth, your lungs, until you became one with the sea. I could not help you, Rina. I should help you, Amal. I want to help you, Malinka. I don't know how to help you, Soraya. I am helpless. I feel helpless. And so I am wasting water for you, because it's all that I can do. Let the tap run and run and run, icy cold or burning hot, just to watch it flow, because you can't. So, I'm getting mixed up in my pages, I know I would. Continuing on the theme of that I chose tonight, which I know it's a bit heavy, but bear with me. Okay, let me get my pages sorted, because otherwise I will never find anything. Here it is. Okay. So, get comfy, because I'm going to read you a story now. A very short story, and I hope a good story. So last year, my father was 90 years old, and he took the family on a Mediterranean cruise. It was weird. It was a little weird. But the weirdest moment was when we were sailing away from Turkey. There was a big show on the pool deck with lights and a band and dancers, and the 2,000 guests were all dancing away. And I imagined that I was a drone and that I was lifting off the deck and seeing this cruise ship with all the lights and sound, and going up further, all the other cruise ships in the Med, and then up further, and all the people who were walking from Syria into Turkey, and then all those little boats drifting between the cruise ships in the Mediterranean, trying to get across. And I wrote this story called Guardian Angel. Everyone is asleep, or too sick to do anything but lie on the deck. I crawl out from my mother's arm and creep through the bodies to the front of the boat. I am looking for Baba. He left us to go talk to the captain and never came back. That was two nights ago. When I ask Mama where he is, she just cries and rocks the baby. The baby sleeps all the time. Mama has wrapped the rosary that Grandma gave us around the baby's neck. He likes grabbing at the shiny pearls with his little hands, but he hasn't done that in a while. The sea is inky and smooth. The moonlight on the black water is like a road leading straight up to heaven. I find a spot to sit between two barrels. The moon looks like a big wheel of cheese hanging in the dark sky. My mouth waters at the thought of creamy goat's cheese. The boat isn't moving forward. We're just bobbing gently in the same place. I can't hear the engine. It's been silent since before Baba went to speak to the captain. I'm very thirsty. I dip my hand into the barrels, but all I feel is empty space. What will we do if there is no more water? Where is Baba? Where are the sailors and the captain? Maybe they all went for help. Maybe that's why we're not moving, so that they'll know where to find us when they come back. I get up on my toes and stick my head into a barrel, holding on to the rough plastic edges so I don't fall in. For one joyful moment, I think that I can smell fresh water, but it's just my mind playing tricks. The barrels are empty. All at once, my thirst rages as if there were a lion in my throat, as if knowing that there is no more water unleashed it. I lick the cold iron of the boat's side and work up some spit in my mouth. I swallow it, pretending that I'm drinking ice-cold lemonade in Liberty Square. Baba always buys me one before we go to the park. On the way back home, we sometimes stop to light a candle at the church of Michael the Archangel. Grandma says that we all have a guardian angel who watches over us. I lie down between the barrels and try to be brave. I tell myself this is an adventure, and I am the girl who will be saved by her Baba and the valiant captain, guided by her guardian angel. I pull Baba's big puffy jacket around me and close my eyes, letting the tale of the girl who was saved run through my head like a television show. I doze, dreaming of a long straw sticking out of a bucket of ice-cold lemonade. Something is jabbing my hip. I unzip the pocket of the jacket, and my heart leaps as my fingers recognize the shape of a plastic Diet Coke bottle. Then just as quickly, my heart sinks as I remember my grandma giving it to Baba with the rosary. It's holy water from the Virgin Mary's house in Turkey. You can't drink holy water. I look up at the night sky and try to imagine our Holy Mother floating on the wispy cloud that is passing across the moon. Surely she would understand if I drank her water. If I prayed while I drank it, it might not be a sin. I could offer it up. Drinking the holy water could make the prayer more powerful. I say three Hail Marys and one Our Father for good measure. My hands are shaking as I uncap the bottle. I ask our Holy Mother to send my guardian angel to come and rescue us. I want to save some for Mama and the baby, but once I start drinking, I can't stop until the very last drop. I ask for forgiveness for my greed. Then I close my eyes and start a decade of the rosary, counting on my fingers. I wake up to a humming in my head. At first, I think it must be the engine. Baba has come back. And then, looking up, I get such a fright that I tumble backwards on the deck, legs and arms caught up in the jacket. A giant white ship is floating by, lights blazing. It's the biggest, whitest, shiniest thing I have ever seen. It's bigger than the biggest building on our street in Aleppo. It is lit up like a football stadium. I can see rows of little windows, some with shadows moving behind the drawn curtains. There are two rows of balconies above the windows. I see a man sitting on a chair. I can see the red glow of his cigarette. I should run and wake the others, but I can't move. Suddenly a door slides open, and a woman runs out on the top deck. She is beautiful, like a film star. She has long blonde hair that spills over her shoulders. They are so white that they seem to shine. Her dress is gold and sparkles. I imagine that she has red lipstick and long painted nails. As she pulls a cigarette from her purse and tries to light it. Then she throws the cigarette, her lighter, and the purse overboard. The woman's long hair sways below the railing as she leans over and hangs her head. Then she straightens up and starts walking to the back of the ship. The boat is slowly passing, but she stays in front of me as she walks along the deck. She stops and bends down to take off her heels and carries on barefoot. Our boat starts to rock as the ship's waves roll in to meet us. I can hear shouting behind me. Any minute now, someone will see us. Someone will hear us. The ship keeps moving forward. Soon, it will be too far to hail. The woman reaches the back of the ship and looks out over the road of moonlight, floating in the ship's wake. I can hear them screaming on the lower deck. I look down and see a crowd of tiny lights being waved. Lighters, torches, mobile phone. The woman takes no notice of the shouting. She stands very still, her outstretched arms holding the railings. The ship is passing by. The boat rocks violently as the giant wake hits us. I get on my knees and clasp my hands in front of my face. A wave lifts the boat, and I get a good look at the woman, standing at the back of the ship as it pulls away. I see her raise her chin and close her eyes. I raise my chin and close my eyes. When I open them again, she is standing on the railing. I watch as she raises her arms, casting wing shadows on the deck as she dives off. For a moment, she is suspended in the graceful arc of her flight across the moon. She plunges into the water with barely a splash. I do not notice the people running up on the deck. I do not hear the sirens going off. I am searching the water for my guardian angel, waiting for her golden head to pop out of the water and rescue me.
That was longer than I timed. Thank you for listening. I'll do one more. Shane wrote a poem about Alan Kurdi, and so did I. I'm getting some water for this.
I saw you in every child I passed today. One little boy had the very same shoes. He jumped and laughed, ran circles around me, and I wanted to catch him and smother him with kisses, feel his soft baby breath, the silky touch of his curls, pretend it was you, and erased the grief that echoed around the world with the picture taken on a Turkish beach where you should have been playing with your brother. You looked so small, lying there, as if asleep. The round, big head, the bulge of a nappy in your blue shorts, your plump little fingers on the sand. I hope it was quick, that the water took you as you slept before you left your mother's arms. And I wish that my words had magical powers to weave a different story for you, sweet boy. One where angels lift you out of the waves and leave you on the shore. Where dolphins swim you out of danger, or mermaids carry you to safety, past the sharp rocks, into the shallow water, near the sandy beach, where I sit and wait for you to crawl out of the sea, straight into my arms. Straight into my arms. Straight into my arms. I wish you'd crawl out of the sea, straight into my arms, straight into my arms. I wish you'd crawl out of the sea, straight into my arms. Oh, I wish you'd crawl out of the sea, straight into my arms, straight into my arms. Oh, you crawled out of the sea, straight into my arms, straight into my arms. Mm-hmm. Thank you.